Accession number 29076, Reel 4.
Operations. But in the early days, when we're told to go down after these great swarms of bombers, you just break up one by one and go down after them. And if, on the other hand, we were attacked from above or whatever, there was usually a call for Christ's sake, you know, watch out, Red 3 or whatever it is, there's somebody coming down after you. You go into a steep turn straight away, and to hell with any formation flying with anybody else, you'd do your best to get out of it. Of course, if you saw one of your own chaps, you know, there's a convenient position where you could help, you did, but that wasn't very often. And then, as I say, in these big brawls we used to have with so many aircraft flying around, one moment there's a mass of them, and the next moment, clear air, very strange.
And was it the common practice to then, once you've made your initial pass,
and was it
when you've found that there's no one else?
Oh, I used to go home. I mean, I didn't look around for trouble. I suppose, I think when later days when they were flying over France, I think quite a lot of people did look around, but it was dangerous work because there we had the enemy up in the sun most of the time and looking out for us, whereas here they were mostly escorting and usually split up from the bombers by the time you know, they'd been attacked. So it was every chap for himself, really.
Your flights were all in radio contact?
We were on an old-fashioned TR-9, I think it was called, sort of push-pull thing, which gave you, you were normally listening to bass control, or squadron commander, but you could also put it on, speak and talk to other people in the squadron, but you were duty-bound not to do that during any action or going up to an action, because you could give your place to enemy wanting to hear, you know, comment on tactics and so on. Nevertheless, quite a lot was recorded, I think, and people were heard by the girls back in at control, you know, the sector headquarters or whatever it was, and using fairly fruity language to each other, and particularly to warn other people of, you know, who was around and so on. And as several of the girls said, the awful thing was when they heard chaps were screaming as they went down in flames, you know, that sort of thing. There was a certain amount of that, I suppose, but you were not supposed to use the air unless you had to. Yes. See, the Spitfire, I think similar to the Hurricane, had a tank of about 45 gallons in front of you, and you were separated by a sheet of armour plating. It was quite a nice chunk of 3/8 inch, I think it was. It was quite thick, armour plating. And behind you, you had a protection again of another sheet of armour plating. And when I got shot up, I had one or two armour-piercing bullets came through it, actually. But mostly, they dent themselves on it. And if it's an ordinary bullet, they do. Which was some good protection. But, of course, incendiaries going into the petrol tank was the thing we always dreaded, because that could be nasty. Yes.
Nigel Rose, Reel 4.
We already on to 3 or 4. Well, this went on for some time. I came back from sick leave, what it was so called. I really felt a fraud about that. But we went on doing these patrols at 3 or 4 every day, well, for a long time. And didn't see an awful lot of the enemy. I don't know. My logbook gets very quiet then. Whether it's because for some reasons we didn't get into action very often. We were obviously sent up because there was something coming over, but whether we were sent up with more raids coming into London or Portsmouth or Bristol or somewhere, or more, I think, perhaps into London then, and maybe we were sent up as long stop of Sussex and didn't reach there in time, I don't know. But we had a certain amount of action, but not nearly so much. And the Germans, of course, by the end of September, had rather given up the idea of invasion. I can remember, I think it was the end of August or beginning of September, there was a sort of or middle of September, there was a sort of cut-off day when I think the Germans actually gave up definitely the idea of getting their barges across. And at the same time, I think they reduced their raids to some extent and increased the ones going over London at night. And I suppose October, November, the days are getting shorter and all that, so there was less activity. But by then, it was certainly dying down. And I find my diary is getting much quieter in October, November. We had, certainly had one action at the end of October. And then November, very little. And December, we got a posting to go back up to Scotland because we were Scots Squadron. And, of course, not only most of the air crew, but not by no means all by now, were Scots, but practically all the ground crew were fitters and riggers. I haven't mentioned them, but one oughtn't really to mention anything about you know, what went on in those days. These blokes were absolutely marvellous. I mean, you had to admire them. They took as much sort of genuine interest in how well you'd done when you were up on these trips as you did yourself. And they were swarming up all over you when you landed with either refuelling or rearming. And riggers were checking over the thing for bullet holes and anything that might be needed to be dealt with. But they were absolutely wonderful, a very cheerful lot too. And in our case, they were billeted in the stables, I think, was it? They had a fairly rough time, I think, most of them, at West Hampton, because we were, as I said, a field, you know, with a couple of fields, really, which had been knocked together. Did I mention that? The airfield. West Hampton, the hedges, I think I told you, the hedges had been taken out and the ditches filled in, and it was one vast field, fairly vast, not really quite big enough for Spitfires and Hurricanes, but big enough for, if you're careful. And at any rate, we had we had the local vicarage, I think it was, or farm, a big farmhouse on the edge of the airfield. West Hampnett it was a parish with a church of its own, and it was on the borders of Goodwood, and Goodwood took the name. And when this airfield was given runways, and it began to be known as Goodwood, and then became a racetrack for racing cars, and I think there was after the war there was a private airfield or something, parachute training and things. But largely, it became known for its racetrack, which was the perimeter track that had been put in. We had hard standings. I can't remember whether there was a perimeter track. Well, there were no runways when we went there. I don't know if there was a perimeter track. I don't think there was. But there were certainly hard standings where we could taxi the aircraft out and park them for the night. The Germans, I don't think, ever found West Hampnett. At least I don't remember getting bombed there. We had quite a few around, and Ford is fairly close, and there was a night fighter station there, which I suppose may have been why we were. I don't think ever did a fighter night there. I think we one flight took off, one section took off. Certainly, I think it was when I was on sick leave. It's in my logbook. Three odd chaps, and they'd never flown a Spitfire at night. They took off at dusk, and it got pretty dark by the time they arrived. And they all three overran the airfield and crashed their aircraft. No, I don't think any of them were injured, but they made a rather sort of sad mess of the front end of the aircraft and the propellers. Well, we weren't really trained for flying Spits at night in those days, but I don't think many people were. And it was, we may perhaps move on to another, if you want to another session up in Scotland, but there we were flying by night. But it was a dead loss, because the exhaust butts, you know, from the manifold butts from the aircraft, they used to put what a cool thing to keep the light out of your eyes.
Visor?
No, not a visor. sort of eye shield thing, okay? It was to try and stop the blinding. It'll come to me. And they were bolted on both sides to keep the glare from getting in your eyes, you see, because the glare from these engines was pretty bright, so you couldn't see anything ahead, really, without these things. And the exhaust... I think I got it somewhere. Anyway, so we did no night flying purposely from West Hampton at all. We had Ford and also another airfield, I think, operating night fighters not very far away. If you hear, that means it's 12 o'clock. You see this owl, it's a clock I've got there, which makes a noise every now and then. Not embarrassing.
What would you do off duty at West Hampton?
Sorry?
When you were off duty at West Hampton?
Pubs at night, but I joined the squash club there in Chichester. We were made honorary members of the squash club, the officers were there. Soon after we arrived, they asked us whether we'd like to join. Everything was very sort of pally in those days, very nice. And so we saw something of the female population there, and I fell for a girl I met there called Pamela Anding, and I fell for her in a big way. Seems to be my fault. I didn't remember much about the girl in Germany. I used to go out in the evenings along. She lived in Bognor with her parents and a sister. Sister used to come to the squash club too, and a friend of mine rather fell for her, so that was rather quite chummy business. Anyway, so I used to, a lot of my time off, I used to go over to Bognor, and occasionally there was a party at the mess in Tangmere. They would want to have a dining in night or something and get rid of some of their hard-earned cash. I forget what we got paid, but it was only a pittance by today's standards. But nevertheless, the mess had a decent sort of peacetime spare little cache of cash, I think. And we could invite the girls along and so on. My Pamela had to be home by, what's their parents say, 12 o'clock or something, which was reckoned to be rather strict. I've got a letter which you may have seen, where I said I think they were rather strict about her, which in the letter I said, I suppose it's a rather good thing in these days, which I must have been a bit sort of... Anyway. So I saw a lot of her. We got married in 4 months later down in Canterbury, and when the squadron had been... the squadron was still up in Scotland, actually. Yes. I'll tell you more about that if you want to hear it. So,
what were your relations like with the
locals?
The locals.
Well, very good indeed. I mean, they were very nice all round. I mean, whatever one was doing in the neighbourhood, and of course, by day the NAFI used to send a coffee thing in. I found I knew one of the girls from there. She was a related distant cousin of mine, and it was. Very nice when you did meet people from outside, and they were the kindest of kind people. As everywhere in the country, you know, if you were in the services, you were they couldn't do more enough for you. It was jolly nice. I mean, you were wearing uniform, and I suppose you felt rather proud of yourself. You know? But my time off after about when is Michaelmas? It's the end of October. After that, until we left, was taken up very much going over to Pam's place. And I remember we were in the Flicks one day, and this was in the beginning of December, and I think it was flashed on the screen, "Will Pilot Officer Rose please report to his airfield at once?" And this... this was we got this posting up to Scotland, which was cancelled because of some reason or the other, so I needn't even have fled. One felt rather proud of getting up in the cheap seats or whatever it was we were in and walking up to the thing with a sort of shadow being reflected onto the screen. Oh dear. So anyway, that sort of ended my time down at West Hampton. And off we went to the north. was called in, I think, at Church Fenton in Yorkshire on the way, and I think consumed the squadron coming south's lunch, which because they weren't know we were coming, and we got in before the squadron coming south, and that was 6:03, I think, and I think we ate their lunch, which they were furious about, and we went on before they arrived, and found ourselves at Prestwick, which was not an international airport in those days. It was another grass field, no runways, no hard standings or anything. And so we landed at Prestwick and taxied in, and there we were. The Scots boys were jolly pleased, of course, because they were near to home. Prestwick to Glasgow is about 45 minutes by road or something like that. And yes, that'll be about it, actually. It might be an hour by road. And to start with, I was billeted in the quarters at the mess. The only exciting thing I remember from those days was the station headquarters catching fire, and awful fire it was, and burnt down quite a lot of, pre-war hutting, I think, because I think Prestwick had been used for the First World War, and then between the wars as an airfield for, I don't know, where would it have been? Not Kilmarnock, for Glasgow, I suppose. Or perhaps it was just an RAF station. Yes, it may have been. It probably is. Anyway, it burnt the place out, and including my little film, which I brought up with me, which I'd exposed on that first thing. That was burnt up. I got a print of it, anyway. And I don't think there were any fatalities, but it did an awful lot of damage to the place. We were in Nissen huts, which weren't involved in the fire. And then we had one or two excitements. They came to make a film called The Yank in the RAF, I think it was, and which was, what was the name of the film star in that? If we have lunch together, I'd probably come to mind next week after a half pint or so. We did a whole lot of rapid takeoffs, running from the flight hut and getting strapped in and taking off and as fast as we could, then flying back over the airfield in close formation, I think, mostly. This was for part of the flying sequences of this film, Yank and the RAF. He was all the girls' favourite film star at the time. We never saw him. We saw him a lot of the cameramen and the chaps filming all this and their advisors, because we used to meet in the pubs afterwards, and they used to stand the drinks, which was good show. But we never saw the stars of the film. I think that was just taken home in cans or something. Anyway, that was one of the excitements. The other excitement was a chap landing in flames. I don't know what happened. His engine burnt up and he'd crashed the plane and been knocked unconscious, and he got burnt up in his cockpit. It was awful. It really was terrible. I remember, you know, this was sort of in full sight of all the rest of us, and the fire people, they could just put their spray on the thing, but it was far too late to do any good. Then we did a lot. We did a certain amount of night flying, because the Germans were raiding Clydeside quite a lot. And we were sent up to fly from 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17,000, something like that, stepped up above the AirCAC, which was firing up to about 12,000. So we were doing above that, and which was supposed to be the height at which the enemy were flying. They sent over their Dorniers and Hankels and things and Ju-88s, quite a lot of them. And they did a few big blitzes on Clydeside and ruined a lot of works and things, and did a lot of damage, and a lot of damage to Glasgow as well. And RCO, Sandy Johnson, his wife was in a maternity home having their first infant that night, the first night of the first Clydeside Blitz. Poor chap, he was flying, looking down on this blazing inferno, because where he was, you know, they made a hell of a mess. And the only time I saw a German aircraft from up at sort of 16,000 feet was it was flying across the flames, and you turned to go down, and of course he just disappeared into the night. You never saw him again. But they, Spitfire, as I say, was hopeless at night, really, for night flying. I think most people would say that. Well, few got their enemy, but not very many. You see, the days of Blenheims and Beaufighters were beginning to dawn, and Blenheims were starting to get them quite a bit. But and then the Beaufighters, they were really getting to tucked in, you see. And then, of course, later after that, it was mosquitoes, and it was getting more and more technology advanced. Anyway, we did these fighter nights on several occasions, and it was really quite alarming. If they bombed an explosives factory, an idea just north of us, and they hit a particular dump in the middle of it, which occasionally they did, the dumps were very craftily designed, so they were all surrounded by earth mounds, so that if they did get one and the thing went up, either high explosives or flames, it didn't spread to much more. They had to get a lot of combined stuff to do any damage at an explosives factory. But it would light up the whole of Scotland, as it seemed like, when the thing went off. And if you were just taking off at the time, you wondered what on earth had happened. What was about 7 or 8 miles away from this thing. Terrific. And the other thing I remember from those days was flying over the sea at night, again sent to look for... I'd be very lucky to see a submarine, but perhaps coming back from some sort of patrol or the other. But flying below 1,000 feet, you had to look out for Ailsa Craig, because there wouldn't be any lights burning, and there was this great chunk of rock going up to about 800 feet or something in the middle of the sea, and used very much as a geographical point of for navigation purposes, you know, because when there's any light in the sky, you could see it from miles away, but if it was a dark night, you had to watch out for it. And of course, daylight, if it was foul weather, if you were flying in cloud or anything like that, you again had to Scotland to Scotland, and there were mountains going up to 2,000 and more, you know, and 3 or 4 in certain parts, but mostly our part was 2 to 3, I suppose.
Were there ever any accidents?
Sorry?
Were there ever any accidents?
Accidents.
As a result of the terrain?
Because of of height, you mean? I don't think in our day I can remember anything. I mean, in post-war years, do you remember that aircraft coming across from Northern Ireland and with a whole lot of important people on board? Dreadful thing. It was just about 12, 15 years ago now, I suppose, or more, I don't know. Where it just flew into the hillside. Eh? I can't remember... I do know one or two forced landings where, you know, flame traps burnt up or something of the engines, but I don't remember one at night. Don't think so. We were there quite a long time. We went from Prestwick down to Ayr, which had just been opened, runways, a modern airfield. Lowell Guinness was the, of the Guinness family, you know, was the harbour master there, the station commander, Group Captain Guinness. And I remember, oh yes, whilst we were there, May the 11th stroke 12th, I think it was, or 10th stroke 11th, Hess flew over from Germany. Rudolf Hess, deputy Führer of Germany. And you probably know that story, but he came over the North Sea and especially fitted up Messerschmitt 110 with extra fuel tanks and things. He crossed the... northeastern coast, somewhere north of Newcastle, I think, and the Observer Corps there, right on their toes, told everybody around, including all the observer spotter places and RAF sector headquarters and so on, that what appeared to be a Messerschmitt 110, which seemed unlikely, had just flown over the coast heading west. So I was in bed that night with my wife in Diggs, at Ayr, which was about 2 or 3 miles from the station, from the airfield. And I had a telephone, and they rang up, about, I think, 1 or 2 in the morning, and said, come up to the airfield, you're in readiness. there's a plane that's just crossed the East Coast, and you're on duty. I got on my bicycle and shot up there. And when I got up to the airfield, they said, you can get back to bed. The aircraft has crashed, the pilot bailed out, and the Bandit record on the sector headquarters has gone off the board, and so I was got out of bed by this aircraft. The next day, the pilot who claimed he was Rudolf Hess was taken down to London. Apparently, you probably know the story, but he'd come up to see the Duke of Hamilton, who he reckoned he'd met, I think, at the Olympic Games some year earlier, Munich. Was it Munich? I forget. Anyway, he'd met the Duke of Hamilton and reckoned he was a UK gent who he could talk to about a possible peace arrangement with Churchill. And being Hitler's number two. But I think generally the record is that Hess devised this plan on his own and didn't devise it with Hitler. I think that is probably, I think it must be proved now that Hitler had no part in it. But at any rate, there it was. It was Hess, and Hess got me out of bed, which I can't be many people in this country who can say that. in due course, he was incarcerated, having pleaded his cause, which didn't cut much ice with Churchill. It was all exciting times in those days. I'm sure there's lots more stories I can tell you, but anyway, we saw our time out in air. It was now September. No, it wasn't. It's July. July 41 now. Yes, July 41. And the RAF were doing sweeps fairly regularly from the 11 group bases over Pas de Calais and Normandy areas and so on. They went in as far as Lille and perhaps some of them were deeper, but most of the bombing going on was done by Bomber Command, I think, and there was a lot of talk about the accuracy of the bombers in those days, and they were just coming on to these marvellous technological advances where beams were pushed out to intersect over a particular target and so on, and there were things called H2S or something, and all sorts of things which up in Scotland we'd been helping to calibrate. I think we were sent up on calibration exercises where they wanted to know, they knew where we were exactly, and these beams were fired at us, and they were able to calibrate the things. So we'd done some assistance on developing all that stuff, and I think they were beginning at the end of 41 to bring it into action, and their bombing became much more accurate, and certainly in 42 it did. But 41, we went down on August the, no, on July the something, that's right, August 13th was the previous trip down to West Hampton. On July the something, we went down to Kenley, and which is airfield, just south of London, near Croydon and all that area, a little bit west of Biggin Hill. And I mentioned that because on the way down, the squadron, the leader of our squadron, flight commander, I think he was, because our squadron commander, I think, was not well at the time, not sure. That occasion, he was had alcoholic poisoning or something. At any rate, this chap let us down, and with the best of good intentions, we got into the circuit of what we thought was Kenley, but in fact, it wasn't Kenley. It was Biggin, and we had put our wheels down. I was in red section, I think red three as usual, and we were running along the runway, we'd throttling back and just still definitely on the ground, and about to come to a halt or whatever, and a red very light was fired from the control tower, and we obviously hadn't consumed too much of the runway, and we took off again. Perhaps we hadn't slowed up either too much. We took off and got airborne again. So I have never landed at Biggin, I've landed, but I've never stopped at Biggin. Which must be another rare thing, I think, to have done. And one day I really want to call in at the pub where all the chaps used to hang out at Biggin Hill and claim to have missed a drink there only by a very short distance. Anyway, eventually somebody took charge of us, and we circled round, because Kenley is only about 8 miles, I think, from Biggin, if as much as that. In fact, I think it's closer than that. And eventually we found Kenley, which is, you know, a pimple on top of a little hill. It did have runways, thank goodness, but you had to make sure you touched down sort of fairly early on. There wasn't a lot to play with at the other end. But I suppose enough. But so there we were. And
in that sort of situation, how much assistance would you have from ground controllers to let you know where you are and where you needed to go?
Well, so far as the runway is concerned, coming into land?
If you were lost and...
Oh, well... Yes, I think they saw here was a squadron trying to land where it shouldn't have landed. Biggin was probably waiting for a crowd of its own chaps coming in from having had a fight up there and didn't want to... It must have been told that there was a squadron coming down and it thought it was at Kenley, and it looked as though they were going to land at Biggin instead. Will it put them off and tell them to get the hell out of it and for goodness sake, get on to their proper navigational destination? So I think there was a hell of a rocket was passed from somebody to somebody. There was that amount of advice, I think, given. I suppose if a plane was coming in, obviously with its undercarriage jammed or and only one wheel hanging down or no wheels at all, or it was on fire or something like that, I think the chap on control, after he was watching everything, he was communicating to sector where the controls, you know, where the radio is being sent out from, and say, look, tell them that to use such and such a runway or something, or we'll clear everything, we'll get the fire engine out to him and ambulance and everything already, and you know, that sort of advice would be given to the chap.
Did you have a sense that the sector controllers were keeping a close eye on you, or was it a case of you being sent on your way and then up to your own device?
The sector controller, back in the sector headquarters, he would be... mostly, you see, getting observations from the control at the who were watching things, and then he shot it out to, I think that was the way it was, not so much the chap actually on the airfield. I think it was all via the sector control. For instance, for us, it was Tangmere, which was only 2 or 3 miles away. And I think the bloke at our end, perhaps watching... I suppose you've asked a question I've never really thought about, but I suppose there was somewhere at our end who would let Tangmere know that somebody was coming in a pretty awful state. But you see, we hadn't got any runways anyway, so there wasn't much you could tell him. He could see for himself whether the ambulance and fire engine were going out to him. Now, perhaps I'm quite wrong. I mean, I think you're probably right that it was all done from sector the sector headquarters. Yes. You see, Tangmere was the sector headquarters.